Hey there, everybody. It is December the 22nd, 2010, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken, and let's kick things off. When Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum announced on October 22nd of this year that he would not appeal a recent court ruling declaring unconstitutional Florida's ban on adoption by same-sex couples, the state's 33-year-old ban on the adoption of foster children by gay couples was effectively over. This announcement was in response to a case that went through the Florida court system filed by the ACLU on behalf of Martin Gill, a Miami man who wanted to adopt two foster children he and his partner had been raising for almost 6 years. Here to talk about that decision, that case, and his journey, Martin Gill, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you.
Holy cow, Martin, what a journey you and your family have been on.
Yeah, it has been. It really has been.
So let's start at the present, and then we'll jump back to the beginning. 2 months later, after this was all announced, after the no repeal, the lack of action was going to happen, how are you and your family doing? How are you feeling?
It's really been kind of a whirlwind of things that have happened. We just got back from Washington. We were invited to the White House Christmas party.
Oh, fantastic.
The holiday reception, I guess, a little more PC. And we're honored to be invited to the White House.
And everybody was well-behaved?
Well, it wasn't a kid event. It was just me and my partner.
Okay, were you and your partner well-behaved?
Well, there was a lot of free liquor, but we were on our best behavior.
Very good. Very good. All right, well, let's go back. Let's go back a few years. So you were licensed in the state of Florida in 2002 to be a foster parent. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
And I think a lot of people may not actually understand what being a foster parent means. So explain it to our listening audience.
Well, you get you sign up at the state and get fingerprinted, background checks, and they put you through the ringer as far as different kinds of checks, and then you take 10 weeks worth of classes.
Okay.
And the Department of Health actually comes out and inspects your home and makes sure that you meet all the requirements.
Okay.
Fire extinguishers and things like that. And so they put us through all that. And in the state of Florida, that's completely legal. You can be gay. We went through training as a couple. We were licensed as a couple. And we told them right up front that we are a gay couple, and they had absolutely no problem with that.
Okay.
And we passed with flying colors and got our first placement in, I'm not sure, but I think it was around January of 2003 we actually got our first placement. And fostering, almost by definition, it's meant to be temporary. It isn't always temporary,
mm-hmm.
but it's really not meant to be a permanent solution for most kids. Permanency means adoption, but foster parents kind of, in general, fill in the gap from the time the children are taken away until the time they can be reunited with either a biological family member or the time they can be adopted.
Okay. So. Now, I've been in this adoption process for 3 or 4 years now, and I would imagine that it's a much, so I've done the home studies and I've taken the classes, and my gosh, if I get fingerprinted one more time, but it's really, I don't know what they think is happening from year to year that is changing my fingerprints, but.
That happened to us too.
Right? Yeah. It's a treat.
Too long, and we had to be fingerprinted again.
It's a treat. But is it a different mindset going into? I'm not sure that I can really wrap my head around the foster care process, just because, as you said, that it's designed to be temporary. How do you approach that?
Well, we didn't have much choice. I mean, we
right.
looked into international adoption and things like that, and we finally decided we both worked with kids who had special needs.
Okay.
And honestly, kind of our niche that we were going to go for was either HIV positive kids or kids that were emotionally handicapped or had some sort of special needs. And so we weren't looking necessarily for kids that would be good candidates for adoption.
Okay.
And we kind of figured, as with the Loftons, that, the only time they wanted to take away the Loftons kids is the one that seroconverted to HIV negative.
Mm-hmm.
So we figured, we'll take on kids that really aren't good candidates for adoption, and then it'll probably end up being more of a permanent thing. And we also knew that kids would probably come and go as foster kids, but we figured it would be the best way to build our family.
Okay. And then in 2004, so you had fostered quite a few children, and then in 2004, these two brothers are placed with you and your partner.
Yeah. And at that point, we had decided that we had already had six or seven kids placed with us, and we decided that we were going to Georgia because we didn't think we were being taken all that seriously. We felt like they were using us just for the temporary,
right?
For the really temporary cases, and not doing what we had asked.
I love that that's not a euphemism. Let's go to Georgia to fix the problem. That's actually what you considered.
Yes, you wouldn't think of Georgia as being more liberal than Florida.
Not so much.
As far as its adoption laws, it would level the playing field. Basically, it's each judge decides what's best for each child, which is where it really should be. I mean, each judge has to look at all the different needs of that child and determine who's going to be the best parent.
Right.
So we might not have been, you know, going to Georgia, they might have decided against us as well, but at least there wouldn't be a blanket ban.
Okay.
And so we had purchased a home in Georgia, and we were telling them we weren't taking any more kids, and they kept calling and calling, and it was right before Christmas, and they were desperate to place these two brothers. You know, Christmas is especially hard to place kids. I got calls for two this week that I didn't have capacity for.
Wow.
And because we are still fostering. But they called us, and then she went on how it was going to be temporary. She already had a family member, but they have to, of course, do home studies for family members, too, and check them out and fingerprints and whatever. And she said 1 month at the most.
Okay.
And I said no again, and then she said, oh, come on, you could give them a really nice Christmas, and you don't want to see these kids go to a shelter at Christmas time. And that got me. We were already, you know, talking about decorating, and we were inviting family down for Christmas, and we were having Christmas at home that year. And so we said, yeah, what's two more? That's great.
Okay.
So an hour later, they were at our door.
No, it was not an hour later.
It was an hour later.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
1 hour later.
Okay.
Yeah, in general, at least here in Florida, they go directly from a police situation with a protective investigator to your home. So literally, by the time they're calling to place, caseworker sitting there, or the protective investigator actually has them in their office or is calling you from a cell phone. So literally they come, and the four-year-old walked in and looked completely traumatized.
Oh, okay.
And his head was covered with ringworm and just looked awful.
Wow.
And went and sat against the wall and looked at the floor. And the social worker hands me a four-month-old baby and says he's sick, but there's medication in the bag. I'm sure he'll be fine soon, blah, blah, blah. And within a couple of minutes was gone. And anyway, I went and looked in the bag for the medication as soon as she left and realized that it had been prescribed November 6th, I believe. And here was December 11th, and looking at the bottles of medication, it hadn't been opened yet. Had not been opened. And this baby had there was stuff coming out of his ear. I mean, he had a fever, a high fever, and a really bad ear infection, and literally his ear was oozing. His eardrum had burst. And the medication had gone bad because it's a particular kind that has to be refrigerated, and so the next day we had to be back at the doctor getting new prescription.
Oh, my gosh.
But so we said about, you know, we thought, oh, we can give them a nice Christmas, but we didn't realize, you know, what we were taking on. So we went about nursing them back to health, and the baby got better in no time at all. You know, a couple of weeks later, he was just as good as could be.
Okay.
The brother, the four-year-old brother, was so traumatized, he did not speak for an entire month. And then the next month after that, he just kind of whispered, and you couldn't really understand what he was talking about. And I mean, that kind of trauma when you're four, being ripped out of your home, no matter how bad your home is, is very difficult.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah. So it took a long time, really nursing them back to health, and then, I mean, really more emotionally for him. It took a long time.
A month goes by.
And no calls except for the monthly visit. And then it wasn't until 3 months with us that we began to get concerned. And then somebody let us know that the first person didn't check out, but they had another possibility. And then finally, June came around, and there was a visit with the great-grandmother, their biological great-grandmother, and I went to the visit. And she said, "You guys are doing so great with them, and they look so good. Why don't you adopt them?"
Huh.
And I said, "Oh, that's really nice," and, you know, said nice things. But in the back of my mind, I said, there's no way that's going to happen.
Okay.
This is Florida, you know. And we were well-known as a gay couple within the foster system. Even the judges had met us. Their judge had met us before. And everybody knew we were a couple. So whereas some people might have been able to walk into court and say, "No, I'm a single male," or whatever, "I'm not gay."
That was not you guys.
It wasn't an option.
Yeah.
And nor was it something that I would probably have done. You know, I don't take lightly going into court and perjuring myself. So
this is good role modeling.
Yeah. And so we were completely honest about it. And then, you know, toward August, we were really desperate to move. We had to make the decision to move. And at that point, the judge told us that the kids were going to have their parental rights terminated. Are we interested in permanency with the kids? And I said, "Yes, but you already know we're a gay couple." And I said, "I don't know what can be done." And she said, "Well, permanency means adoption. Are you interested in adoption or not?" And I said, "Well, of course I am, but..."
Right.
"But what can I do?" And she said, "Well, we have pro bono lawyers, and we can look at it." And I said, "Great, we'll take a look." And during that process, we had a social worker come out to the house and begin to take their little bios, mm-hmm. to put them out on the internet. They take, like, little resumes, little bios of the kids. And he takes out two pieces of paper and puts down their names, and their two last names were different because they had different fathers,
okay.
but the same mother. And he said, "You know, the best way to get these kids adopted, really, the older one is too old. He's now in kindergarten. He's beyond the adoptable age. People don't want him after kindergarten, and, you know, it's going to take another few months to get him out there. And he's, you know, learning disabled, and he's this and that. And really, he'll probably just stay with you guys. But we can find a really good family for the baby." And so I'm not even going to put down here that they're brothers.
Oh.
And at that point, my partner, who's African-American, said, "Oh, hell no, that's not going to happen." And I said, "My God, we need a lawyer, because this is so not right." You have to realize that when the first day when they came in, you know, after licking the medication and everything, I went down about a half hour later to feed the baby. The baby was hungry. Went and got the bottle ready. And his four-year-old brother ran up from the wall where he was despondent, looking down the floor, ran up, all of a sudden perked up, came to my side and grabbed the bottle from me.
Huh.
I thought, what's this? And he wanted to grab the baby, too, and I wouldn't really let him, but I set the baby on the couch between us, and he sat there and fed the baby his bottle. When the baby was two-thirds done with that bottle, he knew at just the right instant, he took the bottle away and burped the baby, and then he hands the baby back to me, takes the bottle, runs and puts it in the refrigerator, and then goes back to his wall and looks at the floor again.
Yeah, we're not separating these two kids.
That's strange. But you don't realize... It was a neglect case,
yeah.
as well as drugs and everything. You don't realize this little four-year-old was taking care of his little brother.
Yeah.
And a little while later, the baby pooped, and I went to change his diaper, and the same thing happens. He comes running up. He has a diaper. I'm at the changing table, but he already has a diaper in his hand. And I thought, okay, let's see if he can really do this. And in 30 seconds, he had that baby changed. And he expertly wraps up that dirty diaper and went and threw it in the trash, and had him done in like 30 seconds better than I could do.
Wow.
But, I mean, and here the state, you know, so many months later, 9-10 months later, says, "Oh, well, we can get the baby a good family, but the older one will stay with you." Well, I don't know. I wouldn't take that lightly, splitting up two brothers.
No.
That always been together. And, you know, the baby, sure, the baby could probably thrive in another home, probably. I mean, at that point, he would have been, you know, by the time they got through with an adoption, he'd probably be like 18 months or something.
Right.
But the four-year-old brother, I don't think really could have survived, or how well he would have survived another separation, and whether that separation be from us or whether it be from a separation with the little brother that he had always cared for. You know, so I just couldn't see that. And that really became my motivation. And it was that day that the social worker came out that I said, you know, pro bono lawyer from the court, whatever, I'm getting someone.
Yeah.
And I'm getting them now. And I started looking into it. And a week later, I had the ACLU on the phone and began, you know, discussions with them. And a couple weeks later, they were in our home doing like a home study on us, trying to figure out if we would be good plaintiffs.
Yeah.
And luckily, they took our case.
Wow. Because I have been wondering, I've been reading all of these articles for the past 48 hours and just trying to figure out, okay, so what's the motivation here? What's going to drive you to, because it's a big leap for you to put your life front and center in a court case that obviously is so important to you, but like what's really going to drive you? And it's pretty crystal clear.
I might point out that the date that the ACLU actually came out and spent the day in our house was, I want to say, like October 9th of 2005.
Wow.
October 9th of 2005, they were in our house. And so we were in talks with them. At that point, the kids had been with us 10 months is all, but they were already talking about termination of parental rights. No one had come forward for them. And it took us a while to actually file the lawsuit, of course, because people don't realize how long things take. But this lawsuit was 5 years in the making.
Where in your mind did it place that this was representing so much more than you and your partner and your children? Was that, how did that factor into this whole equation?
Well, I always knew from the time we began talking to the ACLU, I knew that they were going to fight it for everybody,
mm-hmm.
and I felt good about that. But honestly, my motivation was my two kids.
Yeah.
And still is.
I mean, yeah.
Anyone that has children, I mean, sometimes young mothers, like, they hear my story and they start crying, and it's like they're heterosexual mothers of toddlers, and they get so choked up at my story because they can't imagine losing their own kids.
Yeah.
But it's that bond between a parent and their children that was the motivation here.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't gay rights. I mean, I'm all for gay rights.
Gay rights are good.
Yeah, they're good.
we like them.
Going to make you jump off the deep end and say, I'm going to spend 5 years in a lawsuit.
Right.
I mean, some people would, I suppose. But in 33 years, this is the only case that actually made it. So I guess the motivation for my two kids was good motivation.
Tell me why you think that is. I mean, it wasn't the only challenge to surface. Why do you think that this is the case that really went through?
Well, as far as personal qualities, people are always looking at me and saying, what about you? Well, I know nothing. Well, I've learned about the law a little bit, but I'm no legal expert. I don't have any great qualities. I think I'm even of average intelligence, honestly, but I think that I'm very patient, and I really trusted the people at the ACLU to do their job and do it right and do it well. And only on a couple of occasions did I say, no, we're not going to do it that way, you know.
Right.
But for the most part, they got their way, and I let them do it, and I was patient with them. And I think that most people in a parenting situation want a quick fix. They want it done now.
Right.
But this took, as I said, 5 years, and it took 5 years to get it right. And then the next thing is that the judge, in this case, decided in our favor. But from the beginning, she allowed an evidentiary trial. But what that means is that we were allowed to present evidence. And then we had another stroke of luck that the state chose George Allen Reekers, and Walter Shum, but really George Allen Reekers was the strongest one that they had. And he is the man of Rent Boy fame.
Yeah.
You're familiar with that.
I am, yes.
And the good thing was, and I say it's good, it sounds bad, but he accused us of being really bad parents in like 8 different areas. I'm probably not going to get them all, but one was drugs, that we would be drug abusers. There was alcohol.
Okay.
One was secondhand smoke, that not only were we going to be smoking, but our friends, we'd invite them over, and they'd be gay, so they'd be smoking in front of the kids.
It's what we do, of course.
We are pedophiles. I'm only up to four, and I'm listening. Oh, we're mentally ill, mental illness.
Oh, my gosh.
HIV and things will, HIV and cancer and blah, blah, blah. We wouldn't live long enough for our children to reach legal age of 18. Anyway, it ended up being a stroke of luck because he took like every generalization that people have made over the years about gay people and threw it at us.
Yeah.
And he tried to throw it at us with some statistics and whatever and some of the stuff that was concocted by researchers, in quotes, like Cameron.
Oh, no.
You know, Paul Cameron. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, he literally, there's a small group of these people. There's about 5 or 10 people, and they, well, really about 5 people that come out with this pseudo-research, and they use all of their own studies, and they have their own little journals that they publish things in, or they pay. There's another journal that they can pay to have things published in. And, you know, no one really that knows their stuff buys into any of these studies.
Right.
But yet they can say, oh, it's published and it's peer-reviewed. Well, it's peer-reviewed by their little group.
Exactly.
And anyway, it was a stroke of luck that he accused us of so many things, but it made our trial much more difficult. We had to find an expert, rather than ACLU. I can't take a whole lot of credit there, but they looked worldwide, internationally, and got the best experts from one from Cambridge in England, who was the dean of psychology there.
Okay.
And 2 from UCLA, 1 from the University of Miami. But, like, for instance, if it was about HIV, they got the world's foremost expert on HIV and new treatments to show that even people with HIV are living much longer and that it wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah.
And, in fact, that's already, if you're a heterosexual in the state of Florida with HIV, that was already protected, so it wasn't even, should have been a non-issue.
I'm still, I have to tell you, I'm still on the 8 categories of why you're unfit. Honestly, I would make that into a holiday card. That's what I would, I would send that out to people and just say, from the family that brings you the 8 vectors of why we're unfit. That's really just remarkable.
The nice thing is that our trial has almost become a model of how to run a trial. When they did Perry in California, they consulted with the lawyers. I mean, that was also an ACLU in part. You know, they cooperated with that. But they came to the lawyers that had done this case and looked at all of our evidence. Because literally, we had gathered evidence from just about every fallacy you can imagine, every like you said, those 8 vectors. And we had done the groundwork, so when they looked at Perry, they kind of looked at this as a model. So you're asking why in 33 years it hadn't been done well. First was, no one asked for an evidentiary trial. Loftons weren't allowed to present evidence.
Okay.
Way back when, Cox was not allowed to present evidence. You have to have a particular trial, and it's almost as though the judge has to say, okay, come present evidence, and then you have to have a plaintiff that has the honestly, the money. I mean, these kind of trials are very
expensive. Yeah.
Thank God I had the ACLU, as well as, you know, we had some pro bono lawyers from Greenberg Traurig, and we had some people from the Guardian Ad Litem's office all coming forward and helping. And I've never seen the amount that it really cost, but it cost the state over $400,000.
Wow.
And I think it cost ACLU probably $500,000 if you counted everybody's time and kind of the pro bono lawyer's time.
Wow. And what this culminated in, and my apologies if I'm oversimplifying this, that it culminated in this common last name, this forever name. I can't think of a better end to that story.
Yeah. That's the one thing that my kids understood all along, that they were going to get my last name, because we all had different last names.
Yeah.
Because their names weren't even the same.
Yeah.
And that's one thing they got. And it's funny because about the same time that our adoption finally came through a couple of months ago, we found kittens in the backyard. And we found 3 kittens. And I said, the first thing they said was, can we keep them? Can we keep them? I said, no. And we're not keeping them. Oh, but we're going to name them. What can we name them? I said, you're not naming them.
You're not naming them.
And so we took them to church, and I gave away two, and we ended up bringing one back home. And about 4 days later, they both come up to me and looking at me very businesslike, and they said, "We gave him a name." And I said, "You did?" And they said, "Yeah, he's DJ Gill."
Oh, my.
So what they got was that if they name him Gill,
he gets to stay.
He is part of our forever family.
Oh, wow.
And with that, you know, I couldn't burst their bubble.
I'm telling you, but that's going to end up being the ninth vector. They have too many cats in the home, and then where's the evidence for that? I mean, it's just a whole new hubble. Well, Martin, I have to tell you, as I said earlier, this the adoption process that I am in the midst of. It's I find that there's motivation needed sometimes on a daily basis. And I just reading about your story and hearing about you and your partner's efforts and just your family, I can't tell you just on a personal level how inspiring this has all been to me. And I'm truly appreciative.
Well, thank you.
But you guys get to just enjoy now, right? We don't, there's no need to go back to court anytime soon.
No, somebody asked me, a reporter asked me, what am I doing next? Like, we're going to go get married or something and challenge that law.
No, I think you're good. You're good now.
I told him, I'm doing laundry.
Yeah.
And then after I do laundry, we might actually make a home-cooked meal. You know, all this stuff has really just been a detraction from what we really enjoy, and that's being foster parents, being adoptive parents, and raising our kids. So, you know, it's like, no, I'm kind of what do they call it, a one-trick pony or something?
That's fine.
I don't have a second act.
You won the blue ribbon, and you won it not just for your family. And I know, again, I so appreciate you sharing your motivation, but you really did win it for the whole community. And you did well, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Martin Gill, an absolute, absolute pleasure having you on the show on behalf of all of our listeners. Thanks to you. Thanks to your partner. Thanks to your family. And go do some laundry.
Yeah, looking forward to that.
Happiest of holidays and all the best to your family. Thanks so much, Martin.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right.
Oh my gosh, I could listen to that all night. I was listening to that and I realized I should probably, you know, welcome a guest. Guest, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good thing. All right, well, let me introduce you. And I got to tell you, guest, perhaps one of the longest bios we've ever had in 2 years of this show. So you just hang out for a few minutes.
Please, abbreviate.
Ann Northrup is a veteran journalist and activist. She began her journalism career at the National Journal in Washington, D.C., covering all branches of the federal government before moving to New York City to work at WCBS on a morning, 5 days a week talk show called Woman. She wrote TV criticism for a nationally syndicated newspaper column, for Ms. and other publications. She was a writer-producer on ABC's Good Morning America, and then a producer and coordinating producer on the CBS Morning News. She then pivoted a bit professionally, and we're going to talk about this, and accepted a job as an AIDS educator and an educator on homosexuality at New York's Hetrick Martin Institute for Lesbian and Gay Youth. In 1988, Northrop joined ACT UP New York, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and became deeply involved in direct action in the streets, participating in hundreds of demonstrations, and of course, Anne, getting arrested, well done, Anne, done dozens of times for civil disobedience, including famously at St. Patrick's Cathedral in 1989. She worked for the Gay Games. I'm going to skip a little, Anne. I'm not going to have any time to talk to you. In 1996, Anne returned to regular television production as co-host of Gay USA, a weekly national cable show. The hour-long program includes coverage of local, national, and international news of interest to the gay community, but really watched by everyone, including yours truly. Anne Northrup, welcome to the show, It's So Gay.
Thanks, Ken. Great to be with you.
Unfortunately, Anne, the show is now over. We have no more time.
I can go watch trashy TV.
There you go. Do you have a sense that you've done a lot, Anne?
I have a sense that I have been extremely lucky to be involved in many fascinating things in my extended life.
Okay. This is good. So we're going to do a little, I feel like we're going to do a little This Is Your Life, Anne. You started out working the news. What about working the news appeals to you? What about the pace and the energy? How did you get into that?
Some of it was a matter of timing. I was in college in the late 60s. It was the Vietnam War. It was the beginning of the feminist movement then. Everybody paid attention to the news. It was the sort of golden age of journalism. And while I had been an art history major in college, I really thought the news was a lot more interesting.
Okay.
And so that's what I pursued when I got out of college and ended up in Washington covering the federal government in the midst of the Nixon administration.
Mm-hmm.
But really always wanted to be in television and finagled a job in New York eventually and moved on into that. I like being where the action is, whether it is journalism or activism. I like being compelled and fascinated by what I do on a daily basis. And so I've been lucky enough to be in a position to be on the front lines in many ways, and that has been a great gift.
And what were the gay stories that were hitting the news when you started working at, say, like CBS?
Well, in the early 80s, when I was at Good Morning America in 1981.
Okay.
I moved to CBS in 82. The AIDS epidemic
there you go.
Was
yeah.
Just becoming apparent. It was literally 1981 that it was first discovered. So that was very much happening. And there were gay stories happening, too. I remember putting Ginny Appuzzo, then the executive director of what was called the National Gay Task Force,
yes.
on the air at the CBS Morning News in the early 80s. So all this stuff was just beginning to appear. And I'll tell you how I came out in network television.
Tell me.
I had been hanging around the offices of Good Morning America in 1980 with a guy I met who was working there who was gay. And he used to tell me there was lesbian hour every day at Good Morning America in the afternoon when the staff would get together. And I thought, oh, that's nice.
Okay.
I'd been out since the mid-70s. And I got a job there, and I went to work the first day in 1981, early 81. And I came in and introduced myself and said, all right, I'm a lesbian. Where's lesbian hour? And they all looked at me like I had three heads and said, lesbian hour isn't about lesbians. It's just what we call the time when we all get around and chat in the hour.
Oh, my gosh. That is hilarious.
So that's how I came out.
And you're like, I knew that. I knew that. So then at one point in your career, I called it a pivot. I was trying to come up with a word, and I'm curious to hear how you describe it. Your move from the news, from television, to AIDS education, to education about gay folks in general. What inspired that transition?
Well, by the mid-80s, the golden age of television journalism had really passed, and it was really getting stupider and stupider, and I was getting very fed up with
okay.
what I was doing at the CBS Morning News at that point. And I just decided over a period of time that I couldn't stand it anymore and that there had to be something better to do in life. And so I quit without any real plan or sense of what I was going to do next. And after a period of searching and thinking, I ended up taking a job as an AIDS educator at the Hedrick Martin Institute mm-hmm. for about a quarter of what I'd been paid at CBS, and really feeling that this was going to be the end of my great career, that I had achieved a lot in mainstream journalism.
Yeah.
I had high positions, but that this was going to be sort of the end. And to my shock and amazement, it turned out to be only the beginning, and to be much more interesting than working in network television. To work for a social service agency in the midst of the AIDS crisis, to go into schools and talk to kids about my life as a lesbian in the late 80s, to do AIDS education, and to be out in the streets with ACT UP doing demonstrations and getting arrested was far more compelling and fascinating than anything I had done in network television.
What did friends and family say when you told them, all right, I'm gonna leave television? And I see the laughter, because I'm thinking myself, you know, I occasionally look at, well, maybe I'm not going to be the dean at a college anymore. I'm going to work for a nonprofit and I'm going to be out there doing this. And then I hear my mother yelling.
Well, I don't think my mother was too thrilled to have her CBS producer daughter suddenly go be an AIDS educator to teenagers.
Right.
But the point that I try to teach people and encourage people to think about is you really have the both the opportunity and the responsibility to make yourself happy on a daily basis. And I don't have any preconceived notion of what that should be. You know, I have friends in all areas of life, and many of them are very happy in their work, whether they are bankers or activists. So I think you need to have an ethical value system and do good work and do it ethically. But mostly the point is to do what makes you happy.
Yeah.
And if you can follow that path, I think you'll find that you can take care of yourself pretty well.
I want to talk about activism a little bit. And we had Kate Clinton on the show a few weeks ago, and we just talked about being able to have that perspective, as Kate has, as you obviously have, of seeing,
Kate.
Oh my God, the first guest to ever make me blush on the air, Anne. But yeah, you've seen activism evolve.
Mm-hmm.
From obviously there was activism before ACT UP, but certainly from the very public ACT UP to what it is now, and I'm not even sure how I would characterize that. How do you go about characterizing that evolution of activism to where it is now?
Well, I do have a long perspective. In my childhood, I was sitting at home watching the civil rights movement mm-hmm. on television and watching demonstrators get hit by fire hoses
yeah.
and attacked by police dogs. I then participated in demonstrations against the Vietnam War.
Mm.
I was out in the streets with the feminist movement. And I've gone in and out of activism over a long period of time. And I think there is a rhythm to it. And, you're active and then you take a few years off and then you get back into it. And that has produced longevity for me in this. I think that all progress that we make comes from a multiplicity of approaches. I think there must be street activism and there must be lobbyists.
Mm-hmm.
There must be politicians who understand, and there must be grassroots organizations in every town, city, and state. I think everybody's contribution helps, and I think everybody must do something. And I would not for a second underestimate the power of people who write letters,
right.
who visit congressional offices, who donate money to organizations, who show up and stuff envelopes. or who get out in the streets and demonstrate. I was out in the streets, Wednesday, three mm-hmm. days ago here in New York, helping lead a march of almost 500 people protesting the Smithsonian Institution's censorship of the Vinerovich piece in the Hyde Seek show. It feels great to get out in the street, but it also is great to write letters and to buttonhole politicians in person and tell them exactly what you think.
Well, that brings us to the current, to Gay USA. When you've spent your career deciding what news to cover, how do you and Andy approach the headlines? How do you gather things together for a coherent time?
Well, thank you for calling it coherent.
It is.
Well, it's an hour a week of us. Sometimes I call it Ann and Andy explain it all to you.
Yes.
and sometimes I call it the Bickersons, which is an age-related joke. You have to be old enough to know that.
I know that one.
Okay, good. But it is an hour that is unscripted, unplanned, completely informal, where we each come into the studio together for an hour a week. We sit at a desk, we each have notes, and we just start yakking. And what we do is tell the news, but discuss it as we go along and try to put it into context for people and explain how to understand things. Instead of just doing headlines, we really want to have a conversation with the audience,
right,
and with each other that illuminates why certain things are important and where they fit into the larger context. And I think that's why our audience is so broad and certainly crosses all sexual orientations, because we do put things in a large context. And
yeah.
we hear continually from people who say, I watch your show even though I'm straight, because you discuss things in ways that no one else does,
yeah.
and you discuss important matters. And we're very flattered by that, and we think it's important.
Now, do you compare notes beforehand? So now, if Andy, because he's not on the show, so we can talk about him right now. If Andy brings forward a story that you were itching to talk about, now, obviously, you have the ability to reflect on it, but do you have to shuffle real quick and say, oh, I was going to say that one next?
No, because, first of all, we've been doing this together for 15 years.
You guys have a rhythm.
Yeah, and we can sort of finish each other's sentences, and we both are used to contributing to a discussion of a story, so
okay.
we wouldn't dream of cutting each other off. So either one of us could raise something, and the other will have something to say about it, and that's fine. That is our natural rhythm. And we rely on a lot of the same sources. So
okay.
we've seen, I would say, 85% of what we talk about, we've both seen. We each occasionally have things the other hasn't seen, and we sort of enjoy surprising each other sometimes with stories and responding and reacting spontaneously to those. That's a lot of fun. And we'll argue about stuff if we disagree. I enjoy that, too, because it sort of portrays the diversity of opinion on something.
Right. I have to tell you, one of my favorite parts of the show, and this might come across as a little macabre, but when you talk about someone who's passed away, who I haven't heard of, I first kick myself and say, well, why haven't I heard of them? But the reason that I'm kicking myself is exactly what you just said, that you put them into a context and you tell me this is why this person is important.
Right.
And it's enormously appreciated.
And by the way, our new theme for the show, which we finally changed after about 25 years of disco music, is a Saint-Saëns number called Danse Macabre.
Oh, look at that. It's like I knew, except, you know, I didn't.
Exactly.
Well, so that brings us to the news today, Anne.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. So when all the news is one story, does that excite you or does that make you say, oh, gosh, everything is don't ask, don't tell?
I have very mixed feelings.
Yeah.
And what I will discuss on the show next week, because I don't get back in the studio till next Tuesday, is my mixed feelings about this. Because on the one hand, of course, this truly is an historic day. This is probably the biggest acknowledgement by the federal government of our existence and our humanity and our legitimacy as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an exciting and important moment that we all need to take extremely seriously.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, I have a few nits to pick with the president in his speech. You know, I don't particularly want to justify our existence on the grounds that we save straight people who've fallen down the ravine.
Right.
You know, that didn't thrill me as an anecdote. And or that we are big, tough, killer Marines who go out and murder a lot of people.
Right.
You know, those just struck me as slightly tone deaf. I'm a little sick of that.
Yeah.
Big, tough, killer Marine story. And to say that our stories are lost to history is a denial of all the books that have been written
exactly.
by gay historians about our service. So, you know, I thought that was a little strange. So, you know, these are small things, but they, to me, as someone who follows this stuff on a daily basis, it's a signal that we're not quite there yet in the full understanding, right. although certainly 99% of the way on this story. And what actually struck me as most interesting about this was what the president then was asked about in his news conference later in the afternoon, and that the Advocate writer Carrie Elleveld also asked him about in an interview, which is his views on marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the mainstream press in particular is immediately extrapolating this to marriage is fascinating.
It is.
Yeah, because it really is the signal that once you get us to this point of legitimacy, every other domino has got to fall.
The grounds are minimal. Did you watch C-SPAN quite a bit on Saturday?
I did. I watched a lot of the debate and I watched the vote.
Any response to the fact, I have to tell you, it perhaps was the most C-SPAN I've ever watched in my life, but cumulatively in that moment. When John McCain, do I need to go on? But when John McCain, when he actually said, and I was listening, that there are Marines without legs because they were distracted, and if we repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, essentially there will be more Marines without legs because there will be more distractions. And I didn't quite know what to do with that.
I think that's exactly the right reaction.
Okay. Just checking. All right. Let me throw some other stories out at you. Because there actually were some other stories, not a ton.
Sure.
What do we make of Kevin Spacey?
Well, that's the irony.
Yeah.
I mean, here we have Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal being signed, the President of the United States and 2/3 of the Senate and, you know, whatever it is, 60% of the House standing up and saying gay people are legitimate human beings who can serve openly in the military and everybody has to get along with them. And Kevin Spacey still won't come out.
Exactly.
Now, what is that? I do have a theory of privilege that, and some of this comes from the work I did in the schools, that when I went to the South Bronx to talk about being a lesbian, the kids there totally got it, were totally sympathetic, understood oppression, understood the need for all of us to hang together to, you know, fight the power. But when I would go to private schools, which frankly are where I grew up, there was a lot more resistance. And I think there is a reluctance among people in power to do what they think of as giving up privilege and assuming minority status. And people like Kevin Spacey are afraid of assuming minority status.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real shame, because what I certainly have found in my trajectory from my private school days and my, producer for CBS News days and all of that, and going to where I've gone, is how much more fun I have in life and how successful I've been being out and being an activist. And what I have urged people to understand over the years is that coming out, for most people, you know, certainly there are dangerous situations, and I'm not suggesting people be careless and reckless about this,
mm-hmm.
but that coming out makes you, in fact, safer, happier, and more successful.
Right.
You know, we're very groovy these days.
We're doing all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, for the most part, there are certainly still enormous problems. And, you know, we still don't have job protection, and we don't have benefits. And even the people serving in the military are not going to get equal benefits for their spouses or partners. And transgender people are still not going to be welcomed into the military, even though they
Indeed.
Are in Canada and
yeah.
Australia and who knows where else. So there are all sorts of issues still to attack. But Dan Choi said something today about, you know, this is a repudiation of shame. And I think that's an excellent, excellent thought to carry through here.
Well, let me throw one more thread of news stories out at you, and in particular, because you've done so much work in schools. A lot of the stories that were coming out yesterday and today, and obviously over the past couple months, but really culminating in the past 48 hours, were the proposed actions taken by parents of children who, kids who have killed themselves against the schools. Now, particularly in the Rutgers case, the focus has been on the roommate and the roommate's friend who filmed the video. But now they are saying that the parents of Tyler Clementi, that they might be taking action against Rutgers.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the other states, and I have to look real quick, in Central California, the parents will be taking action.
Beth Walsh.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
What do you think about action against the schools?
I certainly think it's important that parents stand up to schools that are doing nothing about bullying.
Yeah.
In these particular suicide cases, I can't say that I know enough to know whether these particular cases are appropriate for that, particularly the Rutgers case I have questions about.
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely, you know, for years people have been winning cases against school districts and schools that do nothing about bullying. I think it is crucial that we stand up and complain about that and bring lawsuits if necessary. But I will tell you the thing that is most exciting to me, and I think is going to be a tough row to hoe, as they say,
mm-hmm.
is the introduction in California by Senator Mark Leno of the legislation to mandate inclusion of LGBT history in school curricula. And I think that
yeah.
is a fundamentally important thing for us to push for. And if I would like to see our energies directed anywhere at this point, I'd love to see us putting energy there all over the country.
That could be getting a little bit more coverage than it's getting.
Sure. It's
yeah.
something that just happened in the last couple of weeks. It's, you know, it's something that's been talked about in various ways. It's something the right wing throws up as a big scare tactic.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, they'll want to teach this in schools.
Indoctrination,
yes.
indoctrination.
Yes, I do want to teach it in schools. I want to teach our history. I am so appalled
yeah.
on a daily basis by how little people know our history.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You know, when you have people who say, Harvey Milk, who was he?
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
You know, it's just frightening.
Yeah.
So, yes, given the work I've done in the schools with elementary school kids who are hungry for this information, I think it would just transform the world if we could routinize ourselves enough to have our history included in curricula at all levels.
There you go. All right, well, I need to ask you real quick about your song selections for this evening, Anne. This is the part of the show where you tell our listening audience what these songs that you have selected say about Anne Northrup. Are you ready?
I'm very old school.
Well, old school, it, certainly. What does Nina Simone's Here Comes the Sun say about Anne?
That I have my optimistic side.
Nice.
And then...
You're just setting me up.
Yeah.
What does Marvin Gaye's What's Going On say about Anne?
That I have my pessimism.
Look at that. It's like we've worked on this, Anne.
So you don't need to. It all just falls into place.
Just falls into place. It's so easy. Well, let me tell you very quickly what you mean to me, Anne. It was 1996. I was in New York City, 19 years old, coming out of the closet or thinking about it and figuring out how I'm going to do this. And certainly, yes, you had all the gay bars in New York City. So I wasn't lacking in content with other gay folks in New York City in 1996. But to be able to turn on the television and see you and Andy on there, to see you talking about gay issues in a way that wasn't being covered, was validating in a way that and I don't devalue my meeting other gay people, but it gave even my own concept of being gay a depth that I did not have and that I appreciate to this day.
I appreciate your saying that, and I think the secret is that we, after many, hard-fought years, have achieved our own self-respect and try to portray that on the air and make an assumption in doing the show that we are worthy of that respect. And I like to think that that's what comes through the TV screen.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to have you on this show. You and Andy are going to keep doing this show, right?
Oh, you bet.
All right.
And people can listen to it on iTunes.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I usually do the setup. Hey, Ann, where can folks go to learn more about all the cool things you're doing?
Gay USA is the name of the show. You can watch it online at freespeech.org. I know that a friend of mine who lives in northern Vermont actually sees it on the Dish Network or DirecTV.
We have it here, Brattleboro Community Television.
There you go. So people can watch it or, as I say, access it anytime on iTunes. Or go to our, and they can get that by going to our website of gayusatv.org.
There you go. I mean, it's a measure of how much I wanted you on the show that I forgot to even let you plug the show.
That's okay.
Anne, all the best to Andy. Thank you so much for all the work that you guys are doing.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you for doing this show.
Thanks, Anne. All the best.
Okay.
Happy holidays.
Bye.
Bye. And that was Ann Northrup, Gay USA. What an incredible, incredible jam-packed show. I want to let you guys know that you can, of course, always get in touch with us here at This Show Is So Gay. Drop us an email at thisshowissogay@aol.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com. And right there on the homepage, you can see upcoming guests. You can click on podcasts and listen to past shows. You can do all sorts of fun things. Learn about all the folks that sit in the hosting chair. ThisShowIsSoGay.com. And as always, stroll on over to Facebook to type in This Show Is So Gay and like our show. Thank you guys for listening. Here's wishing you an amazing holiday, an amazing holiday. We will, of course, be back next week. So get out there, go celebrate, go listen to Gay USA, go learn more about foster care and adoption and all the great things folks are doing. And above all else, remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, what's going on? What's going on? Oh, right on. Right on. Right on. Right on. Right on. Yeah.